Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are opening a file that I think really defines the ultimate inversion of trust.
It really does.
We're going to be analyzing the just terrifying pattern surrounding a man named Martin Hale. He was a school janitor, and his reputation for perfection. It wasn't just a cover.
No, not at all. It was, you could say, a meticulously engineered weapon. It's what allowed him to operate completely undetected for years.
So for this deep dive, we're pulling together a lot of different sources. We've got accounts, companion notes, even some official timelines that concern Hale.
And our focus really is to look at how he took this totally mundane role, I mean, facility maintenance, and turned it into a mechanism of just profound deception.
Our mission today is to try and understand how the person everyone relied on, you know, the one who was supposed to ensure order and security.
Mm-hmm, the foundation.
Exactly. How did that person become the center of this horrific secret archive, hidden right under the surface of the very places he was supposed to protect?
It's a shilling question.
The stage is set with this, this almost misplaced sense of nostalgia. I want you to think back to 1982, Brookside Elementary.
Right. It's the kind of school where, you know, safety was just assumed. Community trust was absolute. It wasn't even a question.
And who was the pillar of that assumed safety?
Martin Hale.
Martin Hale.
Yeah.
The records describe him as not just an employee, but the quiet backbone of that entire school.
And that's where it all begins, isn't it? That operational foundation. Because in any institution, a school, an office, anywhere, the people who handle the infrastructure, they're essential.
Oh, totally.
But we psychologically filter them into the background. And Martin understood this. He understood it implicitly.
The sources really emphasize his, well, his radical dedication. He was there, and I'm quoting here, before anyone else.
Sweeping halls before the sun was even up, making sure the building was totally prepped for the day.
And he stayed long after dismissal. Polishing those corridors until,
yeah,
you know, they had that absolute reflective shine.
This wasn't just standard dedication, though. You have to see it as a performance of flawless competence.
Right. His employment file, which spanned multiple school districts, actually had this description in it. The man with the cleanest paper trail in the entire school district.
Which is just, I mean, think about that. That degree of administrative perfection, it normally screams reliability. It screams trust.
Of course.
But as we start to unpack this, that meticulousness, that perfection, it becomes the single most chilling detail of all.
How so?
Well, it acts as a kind of anti-suspect shield. I mean, if someone is defined by their adherence to meticulous, often thankless duties.
You don't look twice at them.
You don't even look once. They automatically bypass all the mental checklists for suspicion.
No.
His professional ledger was so flawlessly maintained that it essentially granted him operational invisibility.
You look at the man who is the order, and you just can't concede that he's the one subverting it.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack that a bit more. If his public record was that unassailable, wouldn't the constant overtime, the late nights, wouldn't that eventually trigger some kind of administrative or, you know, HR scrutiny, even if the staff loved him?
That's a great question.
How did he engineer his schedule to be both expected and at the same time completely unmonitored?
And that's a crucial intervention. This gets to the heart of his tactical genius. See, he didn't just volunteer for overtime.
Okay.
He made himself indispensable to the very function of the building outside of normal hours. He leveraged the minor failures of outdated infrastructure.
Like what?
A flickering light in the West Wing, a door lock that always sticks in the gym, a boiler that made a weird noise unless he knew exactly how to, you know, handle it. He made sure he was the only one who truly mastered those little quirks.
So when he stayed late,
it wasn't just to polish the floors. It was because, genuinely, the building needed him to secure the systems that only he fully understood. He wasn't just a janitor. He became the building's operator.
He turned himself into a single point of failure.
Precisely. And by doing that, his presence at all hours became a sign of security, not a reason for suspicion.
Let's spend a bit more time on this manufactured persona, because it seems to be the primary reason this whole pattern went unseen for so long.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
This was tailored reliability, and it was designed specifically to disarm people. He was beloved by teachers and staff for these very specific, completely non-threatening reasons.
He was the ultimate non-event. The accounts always describe him as polite and soft-spoken.
Right. Attributes that let him blend into the social furniture of the school. He was seen, but he was never really watched.
And his helpfulness, it went way beyond just cleaning. You said it was almost like intelligence gathering disguised as kindness.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Can you give us an example of that? How did he gain that level of deep, unearned trust?
Okay, so he did it by solving the small, personalized crises that can stop an operation cold. Imagine you're a teacher and a student's irreplaceable math notes go missing right before a test. Chaos, right?
Total panic.
Martin would find them. Or a classroom's projector bulb burns out 10 minutes before a big presentation for the principal. Martin would have a replacement, like, instantly. Often before the teacher had even finished filling out the maintenance request form.
Wow.
The sources use this chilling phrase. Martin was there before they even asked.
Which suggests he wasn't just reacting. He was monitoring staff activity, anticipating their vulnerabilities, their points of high stress.
He knew the rhythms of the school better than anyone. He knew which teachers were prone to stress, which kids were forgetful, which equipment was likely to fail.
That's a form of asymmetrical control, isn't it?
Absolutely.
By solving these minor, very visible problems, he builds up this huge reservoir of trust. It functions like a security blanket for the entire staff. They don't see him as a janitor.
They see him as an omniscient, silent guardian of the school's routine, the guy who just makes things work.
And the more indispensable he made himself through these little acts of proactive maintenance,
the less likely anyone was to question his movements, his odd hours, or his access to basically every private space in the building. This goodwill he built up made the very thought of him being a suspect utterly nonsensical to anyone who knew him.
And tied into all of this operational facade, there's a constant sensory anchor, what the files call the soundtrack of reliability.
Yes, the humming.
His humming. Everyone knew that sound. The same gentle melody echoing through those empty hallways as he locked classroom doors long after all the buses had gone.
That repetitive, gentle tune is it's a masterpiece of psychological warfare when you look back on it.
That's so.
It's an audio signature of harmlessness. Of routine. If you're a teacher finishing up late, you hear that low, consistent humming down the hall.
It tells your brain the building's being secured by the trustworthy guy. All is well.
Exactly. It anchors his late night activities in utter banality. When that humming was heard, the natural instinct was just to relax, to assume the final closing sweep was underway and it was time to go home.
It also confirms his presence without being intrusive. He's not, you know, shouting or talking on a radio. He's just a benign, repetitive sound effect that marks the end of the day.
And that repetition, it suggests a mind engaged in simple, calming work. We associate humming with peace, with routine.
Right.
But in reality, during those late hours when that humming was signaling that the building was secure and everyone else should leave, that's when Martin was gaining the unchallenged, unobserved access that he needed.
Which brings us right back to the sheer operational cover that his schedule provided. Always early, always staying late. It gave him the complete run of Brookside Elementary during its most vulnerable hours.
The transitionary periods, the moments when official witnesses were sparse or just non-existent.
He totally capitalized on the administrative weakness of oversight during non-peak hours.
He had the keys, he had the codes, he had unrestricted time. And because that immaculate ledger of his past employment was so flawless, any attempt by a future employer to call his references would just confirm his dedication.
He was meticulous about his cleaning. And just as meticulous about maintaining the perception of his documented behavior.
He used the concept of dedication to shield a far deeper, far darker form of control.
Okay. So we've established this.
Yeah.
This fortress of Martin's persona. Now we have to shift to the deeply unsettling reality that was hidden by it. The emerging, almost invisible pattern.
Right. And this is the point in the sources where things move from what looks like coincidence to chilling long-term calculation.
And the pattern was invisible precisely because it was designed to exploit systemic separation.
That's the key. The source says every building Martin worked in shared one frightening characteristic. A student always went missing.
And this wasn't one tragedy. This was a dispersed series of what he would see as operational successes.
Happening across different campuses and different cities and over different years.
So if the police had ever just, you know, run a search connecting the name Martin Hale to every building where a child had vanished during his employment,
the pattern would have been screamingly obvious. But that linkage just never happened.
Why not?
The police investigated each tragedy separately. They treated them as unique, localized crises. They were tackling individual human loss, siloed by time, by geography, and often by jurisdiction.
They had no mechanism back then, especially in the early 80s, to cross-reference every single service worker who moved between school districts, especially across county lines.
It was impossible. The data just wasn't connected. Martin was a ghost in the machine.
Let's delve into the specific cases, because they really reveal how adaptable his method was. He wasn't locked into one type of target or one method of operation.
No, not at all. We have three specific examples from the files, and each one demonstrates how he exploited a different time of day vulnerability.
Okay, start with the most seemingly mundane one, the casual vanishing. A second grader who disappears while walking home.
Right. This one targets the periphery of the school's security zone. The child was last seen leaving the school grounds. Now, Martin, as the janitor, would have intimate knowledge of the school's layout, the surrounding streets, the bus routes.
He'd know exactly which shortcut a kid might take if they missed their bus, or if a parent was running late.
And his presence near the school boundaries during dismissal would be completely unremarkable. Maybe he's clearing trash cans by the main gate. Maybe he's moving supplies near the parking lot.
His job description put him everywhere and nowhere at once.
Precisely. So that kind of external disappearance, it's almost instantly attributed to a stranger abduction or just a child wandering off, not to the trusted fixture of the school itself.
Okay, now let's consider the second case. This one is more of an internal exploitation. A shy girl from the music club who failed to come out after rehearsal.
This one is different. It requires a whole other level of access and timing.
Right.
This is a classic leveraging of the late stay routine. Music club rehearsal finishes up, the teacher leaves, assuming all the students have been picked up or have left the building.
And Martin would be the last operational authority figure there.
He would know the exact moment the music club advisor departed. He'd have the keys to lock that whole wing down. The girl, maybe she's shy, she lingers for a minute behind the others.
And then she hears the humming.
The humming would be his signal of approach. The sound of the building being secured for the night. He exploited that tiny window between the teacher's departure and the final structural lockdown of the building.
It's terrifyingly precise.
And then the third victim, a boy who stayed late for tutoring and never made it to the bus. Again, a different vulnerability.
This one requires oversight during what are supposed to be supervised after school hours.
Yeah, and tutoring often happens in these small, sometimes remote classrooms in quiet wings of the building. The main administrative supervision is usually focused on the front office, managing parent pickups.
But Martin's role allows him to be in those quiet wings without any questions. He's just collecting trash or securing the lights.
So when the tutor finishes, that student is sort of mentally handed off to the structural security of the building, and Martin was the embodiment of that security. He could ensure that students simply vanished before they ever reached the main group of kids waiting for the late bus.
The genius of it is the sheer diversity. I mean, if all the children had vanished from the same basement storage closet, the pattern would have been immediate.
Of course. But by varying the method, internal, external, after-school activity, he made sure the cases remained distinct. They looked completely unrelated in the eyes of the police.
This is the illusion of separation, as the files call it, writ large.
And you have to remember the context. This is the 1980s. Police departments were running on paper files. There was no standardized cross-jurisdictional database for tracking itinerant school employees.
It just didn't exist.
The local detective investigating the music club girl in one county would have no budget, no reason, and no immediate investigative path to check if the janitor at that school had also worked 3 years prior at another school in a neighboring county where something similar happened.
He was exploiting the bureaucratic friction, the gaps in the system.
He was banking on the fact that local law enforcement is optimized for local crime, not for these slow burn serial patterns executed by mobile, highly trusted workers.
And nobody looks at the person whose job it is to clean up.
Nobody looks at the person tasked with maintenance and closure. His very function, the erasure of mundane messes, became the perfect cover for erasing something much more critical.
The evidence.
The evidence. It's a core theme of deception, really. The biggest secrets are maintained by the very infrastructure we rely upon for our everyday lives.
It's just so unsettling to realize this pattern existed for years, just sustained by this bureaucratic and psychological camouflage.
Mm-hmm.
And it required a sheer fluke to break it.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to the pivotal night at Brookside Elementary. The night that illusion just shattered.
And the catalyst is almost unbelievably mundane.
A forgotten purse.
A forgotten purse. A substitute teacher realizes she's left it behind. She returns to the building after dark, operating completely outside the established routine.
And the environment here is crucial. The school is silent, dark.
It's a different place at night. When the lights are off, a school reverts from a place of open learning to this maze of service corridors and shadowed corners. It's not the same building.
So she's focused on one thing, getting her purse. She's crossing the cafeteria, and then she hears it.
The sound.
The crucial sound. The sound that should have been comforting, but now it signals alarm. The familiar humming, that same gentle melody.
But this time it's coming from somewhere below.
The sound has been displaced.
Completely displaced. Yeah. The humming, the hallmark of Martin's benign presence above ground, is now originating from the substructure of the school. It's a signal that his true hidden work lies literally beneath that polished facade.
That displacement is the first sensory clue that the world of Brookside is inverted.
And as she follows the sound, she notices a key piece of infrastructure that she and likely everyone else had ignored for years.
A service staircase she'd never noticed before.
And this highlights the operational blind spots we all maintain. This connects directly to one of the thematic parallels we see in our broader sources, like the notes on the hidden workings of, say, Disney World.
The controlled zone.
Exactly, the controlled zone. The public areas are meticulously maintained and visible. But the essential operational infrastructure, the tunnels, the service access points, the areas only for utility workers, they're completely hidden from public consciousness.
So Martin's real operation was running in his own private controlled zone.
Precisely. That service staircase is the boundary. It's the line between the public lie and the private truth. It's infrastructure designed for efficiency, not for inspection. And so it's the perfect place to hide the highest level of deception.
And as she follows that staircase down, she enters a place that contrasts so violently with the school she knows.
Describe the descent.
She finds a narrow concrete hallway. It's utilitarian, barely wide enough for one person. It's lit only by a single old bulb that flickers overhead.
The atmosphere is just raw, unfinished. The complete antithesis of the immaculate, shining floors Martin maintained upstairs.
And this environment, it perfectly matches the truth of his activities. It's a space of intentional neglect. The kind of place where dirt is expected and function is prioritized over aesthetics.
But then juxtaposed against this utilitarian bleakness comes the shocking sight.
Yes. The sight that reveals the true, terrifying extent of his meticulous nature.
The Archive of Erasure.
The Archive of Erasure. Along the walls, on both sides, are neat rows of small brass nameplates mounted perfectly at eye level. This isn't just some dirty basement.
No. It's a curated formal museum, a museum dedicated to his operational history.
The choice of material there is so key. Brass nameplates.
They denote permanence, status, historical significance. They're usually reserved for commemorating distinguished people for awards.
And he installed them in a forgotten hallway under a single flickering light. This meticulous, lasting physical record. It contrasts so violently with the flawless employment record he maintained above ground.
This is the true ledger of his life's work.
And she steps closer. She sees the engravings, names she recognizes from old missing child flyers, names of students who vanished from every single school Martin had ever worked at, across all those years, all those different campuses.
It's an archival system, not documenting his job performance, but his successful acts of human erasure.
It's a ledger of his victories.
The names on those walls are his trophy case. It's the only way he permitted himself to keep a mess. And even then, it's a meticulously organized, documented mess, categorized by name, by location.
It fulfilled his internal, twisted need for documentation while maintaining absolute external secrecy.
And just as she's processing this monumental, terrible realization, the collector steps forward.
Brunton's entrance. He emerges from the shadows at the far end of the hallway, still humming.
Still carrying that musical signature of routine.
The sources emphasize his lack of panic. He's calm. He's still maintaining the persona, even in the moment of total exposure.
And he offers the chilling confession, the phrase that just perfectly encapsulates his entire operational motive. He smiles, a calm, practiced smile, and says quietly,
"I never leave a mess behind, not even them."
That one line, it just redefines everything.
His entire career. His whole commitment to cleanliness. It wasn't about the school's hygiene at all. It was about ensuring the evidence of his specific horrific activities was never, ever found.
So what does this all mean when we synthesize it? The flawless facade with the hidden archive? We have to really analyze that statement. I never leave a mess behind.
His entire life was structured around the successful execution of this one deception.
It fundamentally changes our understanding of what he was doing. He wasn't cleaning up spills. He was maintaining operational security for his criminal enterprise by removing the human evidence.
And the nameplates. They're the psychological exception to his rule of erasure. They have to be.
Oh, they are. They reveal the compulsion that's underlying all that perfection. I mean, a man who achieves that level of external meticulousness usually has an intense, profound need for control.
Right.
So while he successfully wiped the external records clean, the police files stayed separate. His employment history was pristine. The floors were shining. He needed an internal validation, a private record that proved his own efficacy to himself.
The brass plates were his filing system, the absolute confirmation that his system worked flawlessly.
It gives us this crucial psychological profile of the high-functioning deceiver, the external adherence to societal norms, the politeness, the diligence. It's so absolute that it creates a blind spot for everyone else.
The perfection itself becomes the evidence of overcompensation, of a deeper need for control.
And if we connect this back to some of the thematic parallels in our broader research, this speaks directly to the Klaus Richter file. Remember that?
Yeah.
Where the phrase was, erasure becomes the evidence.
Right. Martin Hale's spotless record became evidence of his deception because, statistically, no human maintenance worker can be that perfect without a profound underlying motive.
The only common factor in all those disparate missing person files was the common denominator of a lack of evidence, a lack of any trace. And that lack pointed directly back to the one person whose entire job was to eliminate traces.
And what about the other connection, the source that argues the treasure is usually a trap? How does that apply here?
Well, the community's perception of Martin Hale, the treasure of having such a reliable, dedicated employee, that was the trap.
Mm.
Their willingness to trust him implicitly, to ignore his excessive hours, to vouch for his character. That was the security system he leveraged against the very community he was operating within. Their reliance on him prevented anyone from even thinking of questioning the deeper operational logistics.
So this story, it really illustrates how the most dedicated adherence to a public, mundane role can be the ultimate camouflage.
The more reliable he was, the more effectively he vanished as a potential threat. We are, you know, we're instinctively wired to trust people who uphold order. Martin Hale leveraged that fundamental social mechanism against the most vulnerable.
It raises a pretty important question about how we assess competence and trust, doesn't it?
It does. We mistake compliance for virtue. We mistake meticulousness for integrity. His spotless record wasn't a reflection of his moral character at all. It was a carefully constructed fortress protecting his secret activities that were taking place just feet away, right beneath the surface.
That image, the hidden hallway, the flickering bulb, the array of meticulously engraved brass plates. It is such a powerful, visceral image.
It is.
The sheer banality of the school's infrastructure, hiding this absolute horror, that's what sticks with you.
And it serves as a chilling metaphor for all the systems we implicitly trust. If the person maintaining the security structure is the one actively dismantling the population it's supposed to protect,
then the security is just an illusion.
The entire system is inverted, and the meticulousness of the maintenance worker simply ensures the continued success of that inversion.
So if we distill this entire unsettling account of Martin Hale down to a single core insight, what would that be?
I think it has to be this. Sometimes the person who keeps a place spotless isn't cleaning up spills. They're making sure no one ever finds what made the mess.
That detailed analysis of the operational failures and the psychological profile is just truly unsettling. The sheer discipline required.
Yeah.
To keep that front running for years, moving from school to school, always repeating the pattern while ensuring the paper trail and the actual trails were immaculate. It's just mind-boggling.
It's a terrifying lesson in how systems designed to protect children from background checks to local police investigation boundaries can be weaponized by a disciplined, mobile criminal mind. Someone who understands and exploits the limits of human administration and, well, social trust.
So a final unsettling thought for you to carry with you from this.
Yeah.
Think about the structures that maintain your daily life. Your office building, your children's school, your transit system.
Mm.
The people who are always there, always reliable, maintaining the safety that you depend on. Are you trusting the visible role? Or have you truly assessed the unseen person? And what critical truths are hiding just beyond the surface staircase you've never bothered to look at?
Martin Hale didn't need elaborate technology or complex networks. All he needed was a mop, a a consistent humming tune, and the unquestioning faith of people who assumed that his greatest virtue, his reliability, was the same thing as his moral trustworthiness.
For the full breakdown, including source materials and more unsettling legends focused on institutional vulnerabilities, you can find further exploration over at Ed Inspector Story. Thank you for diving deep with us today.